Brian. I appreciate your very gracious introduction. I had a number of urges during it to correct some of the misstatements, but I will not take time to do it because I have to admit that it was as accurate as the usual story that we read in the political scene. Gentlemen of the press, I have responded to the persistent and gracious invitation of your officers to meet with you in the National Press Club for this luncheon with some reluctance. May I say with a smile that I've been somewhat puzzled as to why you would wish to hear from one who now had only an academic interest in political affairs. May I say seriously that we have thoroughly enjoyed the year at the University of Pennsylvania, that I've found the association with the students stimulating and provocative, and the association with the faculty deepening in its effect upon one's understanding of mankind and mankind's environment. And I responded today to your invitation and accepted it for two principal reasons. First of all, to see again and greet again those among you for whom I have a warm personal regard and a friendship that I trust will continue whatever may be the tides and fortunes of politics or of the press or of education. And second, to assume that you do wish to hear an analysis of the current political scene from a perspective that's just a bit different than the Washington atmosphere at any time. And thus I'll give you forthrightly, frankly, and concisely my view upon the current political scene, particularly as it affects our Republican Party. And I emphasize concisely because I understand that it is your tradition that you have questions, and I will leave the maximum time for that purpose. I'll be very outspoken because I do not believe that I will really serve either my party or my country if I'm any less than that. And so I say to you that our Republican Party in America is in a bad way. You know it's in a bad way. I know it's in a bad way. The people know it's in a bad way. The elections of yesterday reemphasize the very serious nature of the defeat of 1948. The defeat of 1948 was the worst defeat in its impact and implication of any that our Republican Party has suffered. It was worse than the defeats of the last 16 years because in the public mind, it was not a defeat by the champ, but a defeat by something less than the champ, which, as you know, is more devastating in defeat than the other. Or to use another simile, it was a crushing defeat after having advanced the ball to the 5-yard line. And those defeats are harder to take. And with that defeat went the loss of courthouses and state capitals and the loss of congressional majorities and a very wide range of related effects throughout the country. Yesterday's election served to emphasize the consequences to the Republican Party of the 1948 defeat. Well, what then of the future? And I'm going to speak of that with the same, I trust, constructive bluntness that I've just used in characterizing the present situation. Clearly, the Republican Party needs a tremendous lot of rebuilding if it's to serve the people of America as one of the two great parties of this vigorous nation of free people. Now, there are a large number of men and women throughout this country who are desirous of taking part in that rebuilding, who have a very sincere and very basic regard for the role of the Republican Party and a concern about the situation that develops in a country when one party is in power over a long period of time and when there's disquiet as to the trend of the policies of that one party. There is a feeling on the part of a very substantial number of the people of this country, not active in partisan politics in any sense of office holders or precinct workers or organization, that there is an element of unsoundness in the future implications of the program of the party in policy, in power, that there is an element of the lack of morality that's involved in the long term in that program, that there is a threat to the future individual freedom of the people if there is to be an unchecked series of acts under those circumstances. It is the view that this policy of the party and policy in power actually is going down the road of the power in party in power in England today, and that over, if it continues over a period of another 16 or 20 years, that our country would be in approximately the position that England is in today. Now, what of this situation? What of those who are concerned as to the future trend of these policies and as to the basic nature of our country? There are many difficulties in the way in bringing that sentiment, that interest, into focus in a constructive and effective way. And I think we might as well speak of them. In the first place, there is, among those who, as a whole, look to the Republican Party, a very deep and fundamental difference upon foreign policy. There is the difference as to whether or not the Republican policy in the years ahead should be guided and directed toward the alert and continuous participation of our country in world affairs, and through a bipartisan foreign policy mechanism, or whether it should be the policy of our country to fight the foreign, of our party to fight the foreign policy of the party in power, and in effect to draw back from the extensive participation in leadership in economic, political, social, military affairs around the world. It's a very basic disagreement that is clear and evident to all of you in the foreign policy situation. Secondly, there is a disagreement within the party that's of a different nature and does not divide on the same lines as to this question of the extent to which the public treasury can deliver bounty to the people. It's a difference as to might be expressed by those who say, well, it's clear that the American people want a gravy train, and we better climb on board and help dish out the gravy. And it has been called a Me Too-ism, or it has been labeled in various forms of the whole country definitely moving in that direction, and that the two parties should do their dividing on the manner in which it's done and in some of its details, rather than a more all-out or fundamental disagreement upon it. So much just for that broad sweep of the difficulties in the way today of rebuilding, reorganizing, developing the Republican Party in the years ahead from a standpoint of policy. Now, from a standpoint of mechanics, there are also some very great difficulties. It is a tradition and an accepted approach substantially in the Republican Party, goes back over many years and is an inheritance from a period when the party was for many years in complete charge, not only of states but of the nation, that there should be only one organization that espouses, that carries on the activities of the Republican Party, and that one organization is the regular organization, that any kind of additional volunteer groups or clubs or collateral organizations should be discouraged, should be pushed aside, in fact, sometimes should be kicked in the teeth. And that, of course, has been the situation in many instances that you know of from the 1940 campaign, particularly, and on down in various forms since that time. It's a very understandable attitude on the part of many of the regular Republican organization leaders of the country, but it is also completely prevents the building of the kind of a broad-based political movement that's essential if there ever is to be a victory over an entrenched administration with a tremendous power that the federal government and federal administration gives at this time. It's particularly evident when you contrast it to the developments in this modern industrial society on the Democratic side of the aisle. There have sprung up labor political action committees, consumer leagues, agricultural political organizations, not dominated and directed in their detail by the regular Democratic organization, frequently getting in their hair and disagreeing and battling with the Democratic organization, even with the president. But when it comes down to an election, all delivering votes on the same side of the ballot. And this tremendous manpower and womanpower that has been developed through those agencies on the Democratic side of the aisle has been a very major factor in the elections of these recent years. There's nothing parallel to it over on the Republican side of the aisle. And clearly there's also great difficulty when established organization is present for that does not see the need of broadening a base to in fact move forward and broaden the base. And you could all document that with book and page from your personal observations and the political experience of these past years. What then of this situation? These difficulties of policy, these difficulties of mechanics. It is my view that the sound future of the Republican Party for the welfare of the country, and actually also for its own future, is to drive through vigorously and continuously on this approach. First, that it is absolutely essential in a country that occupies a position of world leadership by reason of its tremendous productive power, by reason of its lack of damage in recent wars, by reason of its position in being the custodian through history of a very precious concept of the nature of man, that he's meant to be free, that it's absolutely essential in such a country, in its position of leadership, that the foreign policy of the country be developed on a bipartisan basis with vigorous participation in the affairs of all the world. Now, feeling that, believing that, it is very evident that There is no easy compromise within the party over that issue with those who just as sincerely disagree with it. So regardless of the state of difficulty of the party, and in fact almost because of it, it seems to me evident that in the years immediately ahead, this issue has to be fought out continuously within the Republican Party. We'll not serve the party or the country. We blink the fact that it exists, that we try to smooth it over, that we try to evade it. So it seems to me that that lies as one of the facets of the future of the party. The second important part on the policy side, in my judgment, is that fundamentally, unless the party serves the opposition to the gravy train approach, unless the party serves a vigilant insistence on soundness from an economic standpoint, on some regard for these basis, the basis of individual character. In other words, unless it takes a firm position in opposition to the Truman domestic program, then likewise there is no real service that the party can give. And it seems to me clear that this nation has within its power, its people have the means to go on down the gravy train route if they decide to do it. I believe that if that route is traveled, there will come to be the point where there isn't any more gravy. And then it's either a very hard climb back or you lose your liberties and stay on the gravyless gravy train. So that if this party is to function in the fundamental basis of a bipartisan system, it must be manning the alternative train so there's some place where the people can go if they decide at any point that they do not want to stay on the gravy train. Now that's, again, putting it very bluntly. And on this particular point, I do not claim to know, even though I may be right, that the ultimate end of the excess giveaway approach, of the increasing regulation and control, and the ever greater centralized power in big government, I do not claim to know whether it is necessary for the people to experience the consequences of those policies before they reverse them, or whether it is possible by rhetoric, by analysis, by dramatization, by observation of what's happening in other parts of the world to get them to part from that trail before they have the bitter experience of the ultimate consequences of the trail. I do not know whether it is possible to so reason through, so develop on the part of the majority of the people of the country the importance of that domestic alternative policy, or whether you must go on to a period of bitter experience. It will be interesting to observe what happens in Britain. You all will recall, I believe, that 2.5 years ago, when I endeavored to speak of what would be the consequence of unconditioned Marshall Plan aid to England if they released sterling balances to Egypt and to India, if they went on with ever greater social security programs without the production to back it up, if they failed to take the steps for incentive for production and export, and that these things being so elementary in an economic sense, that if we dished out Marshall Plan aid without those conditions, that we would be wasting some years of the British people and dissipating much of our resources and then be in a more difficult position to reverse the trend for them or for us with the reserves gone at the end of the 2.5 years. Now, I sincerely regret that those addresses I made 2.5 years ago have turned out to be as prophetic as they now are. Because the British people today, a great people, a people whom I'll bet on in the long pull, are facing some extremely difficult years which, in my judgment, will never be pulled out of until they reverse that trend of the giveaway easy approach to the people and the lack of incentives for production. And I believe they're going to reverse them, that it may occur both within both parties, or it may occur over a series of successive elections in the next 2-3 years, and maybe even a coalition government to pull out. But in the meantime, greater difficulty in reversing, because the gold reserves are so largely gone and the whole trade balances are so adverse. Here again, I give you a view. I give it very directly. You may disagree. It'll be a matter of watching what happens in the next 2 or 3 years on these very basic economic facts. But so there may be no mistake about it, I believe that any time in a system of government and an economic system, you make it so lacking in profit in the broad sense, that is, in the receipt of returns for production, for those who produce, you're in danger of undermining the very vigor, the productivity, the strength, and the continuity of your economic system. And on the other hand, anytime you make it almost as fruitful to loaf with your hands or your brain or your capital as it is to use constructively and produce with the hands and the brain and the capital, then likewise you're in danger. And if you approach it from both sides, and you take away most of the incentive to produce, and you take away most of the penalty for loafing, then you are starting on the slippery road to ruin, so far as a great productive economy is concerned. And I believe that our Republican Party, to serve the country, to serve its own best future, needs to clearly draw the economic line in this respect and battle it through persistently and over a course of years. Now then, what are the mechanics? It seems to me to be evident that we will need to organize additional extra organizations on the Republican side of the aisle. We'll have to do it, I hope, with the approval and enlightened approval of the regular Republican organizations. We'll have to do it whether or not it attains that approval. Now, I know that these, again, are rather strong words to use in a situation within a party. But I see no other way of our party coming through in that respect. And this, I think, will take place in reference to the 1950 congressional elections in the battleground districts of the country. It is the analysis of our friends in the country that in 1950 there will be these battlegrounds for the major Republican attack. 11 seats in the United States Senate, 85 seats in the U.S. House of Representatives, and 10 governorships. And on the whole, there will be this battleground for the major Republican defense of existing seats. 6 seats in the United States Senate, 18 seats in the House of Representatives, and 7 governorships. Now, as I see the role that should be taken in an effort to build the party and rebuild it, it is in this area of the Republican attack, of the endeavor to win new seats that are now held by the opposition. It's a significant thing to observe that in the 1948 congressional elections, of all of the seats that had been won in 46 from Democrats, there were just 16 that were held in the defeat of 48. In other words, there were 70 approximately seats won, as you know, in 46. And of those 70, throughout the country, just 16 of them were able to buck the adverse trend and in these difficult districts hold those seats. 14 of those 16 were veterans of World War II. The men who held the tough districts were men who were outspoken, who were fighting, and on the whole, who were younger men. Observing that fact and that experience, and having in mind the position that we're taking on the fundamental issues, it will be our objective and our hope. And I speak now our in the sense of the broad, uncertain, and to some degree unorganized group that substantially agree with the basic approach to rebuilding the Republican Party. It'll be the objective to develop in these congressional districts and in these senatorial and governorship districts men who believe in and support the worldwide viewpoint in foreign policy of leadership of this country and a bipartisan foreign policy, and who believe in and support a fundamental opposition to the extreme trends and implications of the president's proposed program. On that basis, to seek vigorous fighting younger candidates. And I believe that you will find, come next September, that approximately 50 of such younger veterans of World War II will be in the front line of the battleground to make a gain in the seats in the Senate and in the House and in the governorships of the nation. Will it succeed? I've stopped making predictions about elections. But I say to you in all sincerity before turning to the question period, I believe that it's a job that needs doing. I believe it can be done. And a vigorous, able, sincere legion of men and women of this country are willing and desirous of participating in doing it. And I intend to do what I can to help them do it.